Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. Welcome to episode 26 on September 3rd, 2014. I am Carolyn Yeager, and Ray Goodwin will join us very shortly. As usual, we have a varied and interesting selection of topics, selected, in fact, by Adolf Hitler, as he talks on a wide range of whatever comes up during the after-lunch and dinner time with his inner circle at military headquarters in the East, where war is raging, because we're starting here tonight on February 6, 1942, in the evening. I have some information about the Battle of Narvik in Norway, which we might go into a little bit more extensively than some other things that we cover, because it's very interesting. And here he is. So let's welcome Ray to the program.
Me okay?
Hey. Yeah, I clicked it, but somehow I didn't connect.
All right.
I hear you fine, Ray. Thanks very much.
Good. Sure.
So I was telling you that we're going to be talking a little bit about Narvik. Well, I've got some information on the Battle of Narvik that I want to include in tonight's discussion. So unless you have some preliminary comments, Mr. Goodwin, I'm ready for you to start if you're ready.
I am ready, Carolyn. Thank you. I'll get her started here. 6th February, 1942, evening. If there appeared amongst the English at the last moment a man capable of any lucidity of mind, he'd immediately try to make peace in order to save what can yet be saved. The empire is not sufficiently profitable to support simultaneously the world's largest navy and a powerful land army. The English are in a situation comparable to that of an industrial enterprise that, in order to keep some of its factories working, is forced to shut down the others. The same thing is true of the Americans as far as their interior economy is concerned. Every country, I realize, is capable of moments of collective madness, but at the secret depths of each entity, reason retains its imprescriptible rights. Deladier, Pétain, the average Frenchmen were for peace. It was quite a small gang that succeeded by surprise in precipitating the country into war. And it was the same in England. Some were pacifists on principle, others for religious reasons, and others again for reasons of an economic nature. Why, therefore, shouldn't reason reclaim its rights? In France, the reaction occurred with the speed of a flash of lightning. Pétain's first declaration had a blinding clarity. As for the English, all they lack is the power to make up their minds. Somebody should get up in Parliament and say to Churchill, so that we may at least have some good news for the empire, have the kindness to disappear. No parliamentarian has the courage to do that, because everyone reflects that if the affair ends badly, his name will remain attached to the memory of a disaster. And yet no English parliamentarian any longer believes in victory, and each of them expects discomfiture. All the secret sessions of Parliament are favorable to us because they undermine Churchill's prestige, but he won't fall until his successor has given us an inkling. That's what happened with the French. Their tergiversation was possible only on the basis of our armistice proposals. They began by saying no, then they realized that our conditions were not so terrible.
Hey, Ray, you know,
yeah,
that word tergiversation, I thought maybe it was a mistake, you know, on my PDF copy. It's such a strange word, but there it is in your book. Did you know what it means?
You know, that's one I didn't look up.
Oh, I didn't look it up because I thought it was an error. I thought maybe it meant conversation or something. You continue. I'm going to look it up right now.
Okay. A day will come during a secret session when Churchill will be accused of betraying the interests of the empire. Each blow we deliver towards the East will bring that moment nearer. But we must prevent Churchill from attempting a successful diversion. With the fall of Singapore, the curtain falls on the Far East. The hope that the Russian winter would destroy us is in the process of disappearing. Churchill invites public debates because he's depending on the patriotism of the English people, and because he counts on it that nobody who has independent opinion will risk attacking him from the front. But already several of his opponents are letting slip various disobliging remarks. The influence of events in the Far East is making itself felt on the banks. At present, several of them have to be supported to protect them from bankruptcy.
Okay. It means the act or process of subterfuge or evasion, or the abandoning of a cause or belief, in other words, apostasy.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Well, that's good. It's always good to learn a new word. Okay.
Uh-huh. In any case, one thing is clear. The importance of a nation's fortune is a smaller matter to it if one compares it with the volume of business done in the course of a year. Supposing a nation could import without limit for 5 consecutive years and without exporting in exchange, this would suffice for that nation to be utterly ruined. Let's go further and imagine that for 6 months a people produces absolutely nothing. By the end of that period, its fortune will be scattered to the winds. I don't believe in idealism. I don't believe that a people is prepared to pay forever for the stupidity of its rulers. As soon as everybody in England is convinced that the war can only be run at a loss, it's certain that there won't be anyone left there who feels inclined to carry on with it. I've examined this problem in all its aspects, turned it round in all directions. If I add up the results we've already achieved, I consider that we are in an exceptionally favorable situation. For the first time, we have on our side a first-rate military power, Japan. We must, therefore, never abandon the Japanese alliance, for Japan is a power upon which one can rely. I can well imagine that Japan would put no obstacle in the way of peace on condition that the Far East were handed over to her. She's not capable of digesting India, and I doubt whether she has any interest in occupying Australia and New Zealand. If we preserve our connections with her, Japan will derive from this a great sense of security and will feel that she has nothing more to fear from anybody at all. This alliance is also an essential guarantee of tranquility for us, in particular in the event of our being able to rely on a lasting friendship with France. There's one thing that Japan and Germany have absolutely in common, that both of us need 50 to 100 years for the purpose of digestion. We for Russia, they for the Far East. The English will have got nothing out of the affair but a bitter lesson and a black eye. If in future they make less whiskey, that won't do any harm to anybody, beginning with themselves. Let's not forget, after all, that they owe all that's happening to them to one man, Churchill. The English are behaving as if they were stupid. The reality will end by calling them to order, by compelling them to open their eyes. Japan's entry into the war is an event that will help to modify our strategic situation. Whether via Spain or via Turkey, we shall gain access to the Near East. It will be enough for us to inform Turkey that we are renewing the Montreux Agreement and that we are enabling her to fortify the straits. Thus, we can avoid having to maintain an important fleet in the Black Sea, which is merely a frog pond. A few small ships will be enough. If we have on the Dardanelles a sturdy guardian to whom we supply the guns, that requires no more guns than are needed for the armament of a single battleship. This is the solution most to our advantage. It seems to me that the attitude of the Turks toward the English has changed, that they're blowing cold on them. All right, that's some strong
stuff
there. Yeah,
you
want to
make some comments?
Yeah. When he mentions over here about a day will come during secret session when Churchill would be accused of betraying the interests of the empire, and he says, with the fall of Singapore, the curtain falls on the Far East. Now, this is our date here, February 6th of 1942. Singapore fell on February 15th, just nine more days. Mm-hmm. And that was a British outpost that was considered quite economically important to them and strategically important. So the Japanese pushed them all the way down the Malay Peninsula, and on the island of Singapore and took that. And so the British were reeling at this time, and I think this is why he says during this section, you know, everything like the British are going to wise up and get out of this thing because they can see this is terrible and not going their way.
Right. Right. Well, he says, you know, he doesn't believe in idealism, but he's feeling very, very good about the whole situation. And he thinks they're in a, he says, when I add everything up, I consider that we're in an exceptionally favorable situation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, sometimes he sounds overconfident, but then I can understand that he's sitting around with his own friends and inner circle who are totally loyal to him. You know, I mean, this is the
mm-hmm.
people who are his aides and secretaries and all kinds of people like that. You know, commenting on what's going on and feeling good, you know, wanting to feel good or feeling good, whatever's causing him to talk the way he does
mm-hmm.
during these conversations. And I wonder, sometimes I think he expresses himself in
mm-hmm.
in an overconfident way that even comes across to me as boastful. But I know that I don't think he was at all a boastful type of person. So it's just that it's because I know we're in a position of knowing, I brought this up before, of how it was going to turn out and what was
yes.
up ahead. And he wasn't. So it's very understandable that he would be saying, wow, you know, things are going well and I can see, you know, we're gonna do this thing, you know, we're gonna achieve this thing. And he's pointing out the mistakes of the Brits and so on, which he has every right to do because they were so rotten to him, and things like that. So, you know, but that's the whole difference in reading this. It's that
mm-hmm.
it's that we know, and it didn't turn out well in the end, you know. So not because they did poorly, but just because it was too much came up against them. But
mm-hmm.
but you know, it kind of ruins it for me because it doesn't ruin it, but in a way, yeah, you know. I mean, I find myself judging Hitler in ways that I shouldn't. I'm saying, well, why are you saying that? You know,
well, yeah, that's perfectly natural.
Kind of. Yeah.
You know, a couple of things in here. When he mentions, he says the importance of a nation's fortune is small matter if it compares with the volume of business done in the course of a year. Then he talks about importing and exporting. And, of course, to me, that struck a chord because of the importance of the U-boat operations around the British Isles. And how they were hammering the hell out of British shipping and their imports, and the British were really on the ropes. And I must say this, all this stuff that he talks about, England is going to wake up and they realize they're on the ropes and they're going to sue for peace, or they're going to say, hey, let's get out of this thing. He would have been exactly right, but for one thing, aid from the United States prevented the British
yeah.
from going under. And,
I have to
say
that he somewhat underestimated, and maybe he, you know, nobody else knew either, but the ability of what the United States could produce. Because a few
yeah.
times here and there he'll say, well, the United States could never do such and such, or they're not
yes.
able to do this or that. And, of course, they
right.
were able. This country was able to do it. So
yes.
so he did somewhat not fully appreciate. And part of it might have been because he had, well, there's so many things that could have happened. He was aware of the large German population in the United States. And maybe he thought the Germans wouldn't come along so strong there as they did, you know, like even in fighting in the war and everything. They were in a bind. They felt they had to. They were citizens there, and they couldn't... And they're already being criticized. So, well, the whole thing, things could have happened differently, but they happened the way they did. In
yeah.
any case, the other thing I was going to say about this, if I can remember what it was now, which I don't. So, oh yeah, it was, I wonder how much of what he's saying is from what other people are saying, or if somebody's asked him about something. If he just decides, I'm going to talk about this, you see, we don't have that either. We've brought this up before, which would help, you know. I don't know if he just decides this is what he's thinking about and he starts talking, or if it comes up in conversation and then he starts going on about it.
Mm-hmm.
So all these things just people might consider, because sometimes it does seem in this book that Hitler's just talking and talking and nobody else gets to say anything. It's like he doesn't listen to anyone but himself, which, you know, is not a correct assessment, but it's the way this book is put together.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, I've spent enough time on that. Now, there's a timeline, February 7th, 1942. Americans continue their defense of Bataan against General Hama's, H-O-M-M-A, General Hama's troops. I assume that's a Japanese name. That's a Japanese. And the Americans were defending Bataan. Where was Bataan? I was going to look that up.
It was Manila Bay, city of Manila and Manila Bay, and it was on the entrance to Manila Bay and over to one side, because I've been there. I was there in 2002 in Manila, and I took the time to take the little tour boat and went out and toured Corregidor, and I was a bit surprised that on what would have been the west side of the island, that it wasn't all that far to the mainland. And when I say that, as I remember, it may have been between a quarter and a half mile is all. But it was fascinating. But, yeah, that's where Corregidor was, in Manila Bay.
And so the situation was that the United States was in Philippines, and they got thrown out by the Japanese,
that's
right?
Right.
They were totally defeated there, but then they came back. Okay.
And the last bastion of American forces was concentrated on the island of Corregidor, and the fortifications were such that they were so dug in there with concrete, dug into the mountains and or the huge hills, you might say, and they had fortified that place, and I toured those tunnels, the huge guns that were in place. They could have held out had their supplies held out. They could have held out a lot longer than they did. But their supplies went down, and the men were getting sick and a lack of food and things like this. And there was finally just no alternative but to surrender.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
Okay.
And do you mind giving the little headings for the next one?
Okay. Yeah. The 7th of February, 1942, the evening, special guests are Dr. Tote and Minister Spear. Younger children and the birth rate. America's technology was founded by Germans. And the Fuhrer says, a people rapidly increases its population when all the younger members of a family are in a position to set up establishments. The peasant needs a numerous labor force, and it is obviously to his interest to be able to employ his children until the age when they become adult. If the latter can set up establishments in their turn, they don't remain a charge on their father. But it's quite different when the father is obliged to feed them from his own land and for all their lives. In that case, of course, the birth rate falls. The people in the United States who were originally responsible for the development of engineering were nearly all of German stock, from Swabia and Württemberg. What luck that everything's in process of taking shape on the Eastern Front. At last, the German people is about to regain its freedom of movement.
Oh, yeah, that's a real short one. But, you know, I mentioned in the post about this amongst the notes, because my ancestors are from Swabia, and which is actually Baden-Württemberg, and so I was kind of thought, bragging a little bit about that. But then now I noticed that from Swabia and Württemberg is in parentheses. And there's another place mm-hmm. further on where it's more important to me that something is in parentheses. And I'm saying, wait a minute, does that mean when they put what Hitler said in parentheses, or did somebody add this? And why would they add it like that if he didn't say
right.
it? What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's a very, very good point. And like you, there's something that comes later also that caught my
yeah.
eye. And I thought a transcriber writing down would not normally put that in parentheses.
Right.
And so, you know, it's kind of mysterious to me if his statement was to that very effect that they were nearly all of German stock from Swabia and Württemberg. I can imagine him saying that. If he had just stopped with the word, they were nearly all of German stock, if he had stopped right there, then that from Swabia and Württemberg had to be added a little bit
right.
later by someone else.
Right, and I think the only person who could add it would be Bormann, because Heim
yeah.
wouldn't add it. And if Hitler said it, he would put it in there differently,
yes.
I imagine. So then I think that, and it might be true, Bormann may have heard him talk about that or something, or he may have brought it up in another, you know, a little bit later or something, I don't know. But still, we have to, I think we have to judge that Hitler didn't say those words, that
right.
probably Bormann did. And but I thought that was pretty cool. And I bet it's true that most of the engineers, German engineers,
yes.
come from
oh, yeah.
that area. Because now there's where the Nordics aren't big in engineering. It's these others, Germans are more
uh-huh.
inclined to that and doing that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. Well, we'll have to discuss this more when we get to that other part that we both noticed.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, just as an aside, Carolyn, when I was a little boy, I remember some talk going on. I was maybe 10, 11 years old, and hanging around my dad and a couple of his buddies, they were talking about World War II. And anyway, he and I started leaving, and I talked about that, and I said, you know, something about, well, Americans won because, you know, we just were smarter than anybody else. And he stopped, and he said, son, he said, you think Americans are the smartest people in the world? And I said, yes, sir, I sure do. And he laughed. He said, nuh-uh. He said, it's the Germans, son. He said, they are the smartest race of people that there are. And I never forgot that. And I was thinking, well, if that's the case, how did they lose the war? But, of course, I was only 10 years old, and I came about another 15 years later to realize why. But, yeah, he said that, and not only that, but he told me, he said that he was, when he was a little boy, he was told that part of our family ancestry came from Bavaria. And I tried to track that down, but I even got my youngest son on it, who's really a whiz on computers and everything, and about searching lineage and things like that, but he couldn't find much either.
Oh.
But anyway,
well, I'm lucky. I've been doing that. I'll get over this real quick. I've been working on that myself. In fact, I even posted my ancestry on my website now. If you look hard, you can find it. But I'm still working on it, and I am finally coming to what I always thought, that it was from the Southwest Germany. That's it. And because my ancestors were all from the same area, they're all close together in knowing each other and so on, that they in a kind of a community that was outside of Germany too, which kept them together. It's easy to find it back to there. And anyway, I'm still working on it, so eventually I'll be talking about that. So we've got
Great.
A timeline coming up here for February 8th. The German, now this is a big mistake, you see. I shouldn't even waste the time maybe. But I found that in the timeline they had for February 8th, 1942, what actually happened on February 8th, 1943, which is that the Germans are driven from Kursk by the Red Army. So that just shows you can't depend on anything. I was looking for that. I spent a lot of time looking for this February 8th, 1942 event, and nothing ever came up until I realized that it was what it was, the 1943. So, so much for good old internet sources. And Wikipedia is not the worst, that's for sure. But you can find all kinds of errors. All right.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I'm done.
Okay, the 8th of February, 1942, midday, special guests, Speer and Himmler. Once more about justice, penalties in wartime, the solution of the religious problem. Our judicial system is not yet supple enough. It doesn't realize the danger that threatens us at this moment by reason of the recrudescence of criminality. And that word recrudescence does mean like a new breakout after a dormancy in criminality. It has again been brought to my attention that very many burglaries committed by recidivists are punished by terms of penal servitude. If we tolerate it, that assaults may be made with the help of the blackout, in less than a year we shall arrive at a state of security which will be most dangerous for the whole population. England is already in this situation, and the English are beginning to demand that recourse should be had to the German methods, which, for my part, I find insufficiently draconic for the period. In some parts of England, the proportion of merchandise stolen is estimated at 40%. During the First World War, a deserter was punished by fortress arrest and reduction in rank. But what about the courageous soldier? What had he to put up with? The citizen who traded on the black market in the rear came out of it very nicely. Either he was acquitted, or he had a magnificent time of it reserved for him in prison. The victims of the thefts had no choice but to earn again, by the sweat of their brow, whatever had been stolen from them, whilst the thief could spend his time causing the product of his thefts to multiply. In every regiment, there were likewise scoundrels whose misdeeds were punished by 3 or 4 years' imprisonment at the most. That's what embittered the troops. It's a scandal that, at a time when an honest man's life is so fragile, these black sheep should be supported at the expense of the community. After 10 years of penal servitude, a man is lost to the community. When he's done his time, who'd be willing to give him work? Creatures of that sort should either be sent to a concentration camp for life or suffer the death penalty. In time of war, the latter penalty would be appropriate, if only to set an example. For a similar reason, second-rate criminals should be treated in the same fashion. Instead of behaving in this radical manner, our judicial system bends lovingly over individual cases, amuses itself by weighing the pros and cons and in finding extenuating circumstances, all in accordance with the rights of peacetime. We must have done with such practices. The lawyer doesn't consider the practical repercussions of the application of the law. He persists in seeing each case in itself. The criminal, in his turn, is perfectly familiar with the procedures of the system and benefits by his familiarity with it in the manner in which he commits a crime. He knows, for example, that for a theft committed on a train, one is punished with a maximum of so many years of penal servitude. He can tell himself that if things turn out badly, he'll be out of it for a few years, leading a well-organized existence, sheltered from want, and under the protection of the Minister of Justice. He has still other advantages. He isn't sent to the front, and in the event of defeat, he has chances of rising to the highest offices. In the event of victory, finally, he can reckon on an amnesty.
That's
in
really
such
something,
cases,
isn't it?
Excuse me?
That's really something.
Yeah.
The way he puts that, that really impressed me. You know, that
yes.
so right. It's set up so that criminals can succeed better than honest people.
Yes. Manipulate the system. The system works for them. Yeah.
Exactly. It's manipulating the system.
Mm-hmm. In such cases, the judges should exercise the discretion which is at their disposal but not all of them understand this. And what he's saying right there to me, Carolyn, is that these judges certainly have leeway in their assignment of punishment, and when they hand out these meager sentences where the common criminal or a dangerous criminal is going to be behind bars for maybe 18 months or 2 years, and they think this is adequate punishment, I think what Hitler's saying here is in wartime, the danger of such things and such behavior is multiplied, and that that people who do these things when you're trying to fight a war for survival should be punished much, much more severely. And I think that's what he's fixing to get into with these the following comments.
Yeah, and you know, considering that too, you know, it came to my mind real strongly when he's talking about this that he was someone who would never steal a thing. You know, he talks mm-hmm. about these criminals and so on, crooks.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't have any sympathy with them because it's not something he would ever do or ever did do. So he's kind of intolerant about it, which is what we should be in a proper society.
Yes.
We shouldn't be tolerant to have thieves around us breaking
That's right.
And the victims of these people. Well, you might say, well, they weren't killed or anything. They still, it hurts and upsets their lives quite a lot.
That's right. And the only thing that can stop it is intolerance for it.
That's right. Yeah, I mean,
you know, so what he's saying here is exactly the path that should have been followed in the, mm-hmm. in his judicial system.
Yeah.
The evil that's gnawing our vitals is our priests of both creeds. I can't at present give them the answer they've been asking for, but it will cost them nothing to wait. It's all written down in my big book. The time will come when I'll settle my account with them, and I'll go straight to the point. I don't know which should be considered the more dangerous, the minister of religion who play-acts at patriotism, or the man who openly opposes the state. The fact remains that it's their maneuvers that have led me to my decision. They've only got to keep at it. They'll hear from me, all right. I shan't let myself be hampered by juridical scruples. Only necessity has legal force. In less than 10 years from now, things will have quite another look, I can promise them. We shan't be able to go on evading the religious problem much longer. If anyone thinks it's really essential to build the life of human society on a foundation of lies, well, in my estimation, such a society is not worth preserving. If, on the other hand, one believes that truth is the indispensable foundation, then conscience bids one intervene in the name of truth and exterminate the lie. Periods that have endured such affronts without protesting will be condemned by people of the coming generations. Just as the pyres for heretics have been suppressed, so all these byproducts of ignorance and bad faith will have to be eliminated in their turn.
Well, I bet you've got some comments on that, maybe.
Well, I'll tell you what. That kind of mindset is my mindset, and it's the mindset of most of the people that I grew up around and the era that I came from. You know, to me, it's the only one that makes sense if you're going to preserve society and protect the good people from the evil. And so when, you know, I read his words on that stuff right there, it was like vindication. Because everything that he says in the past 30, 40 years has been particularly trampled, made fun of, belittled as racist, belittled as police state tactics and things like this. And so, you know, reading his talk about this, it just... gave me a good feeling, Carolyn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know he makes it clear once again that he's going to do something about. He sees religion as a real problem now. Although he puts out publicly, and I believe in the beginning he thought so because it's a different situation. It's a very different situation he's in now in trying to build the Reich. And keep it going and growing than it was when he was just trying to get, or I shouldn't say just, but because it was very important, but was trying to get his party established and trying to get some votes into the parliament and so on. So it's a very different situation that he's in now. And now he sees, he's saying in this book, in these talks, that he sees religion as a real problem for what he wants Germany mm-hmm. to be and where he wants what it has to do, and what the people have to do. And he sees this as a something in the way, and that he's not going to do anything now, and this is not the time. But he's saying here, in about 10 years' time, you're going to see something happening. You know, I mean, he sees mm-hmm. it coming up ahead. He's going to do something about it.
Sure. And that religious aspect, once again, you know, comes to the fore if the state decides to dish out the kind of punishment that's deserved. And you have religious leaders then stepping forward and preaching from the pulpit, talking about this is not the Christian thing to do. These people, right. Yes, they committed a crime, but they deserve forgiveness, and let's give them a second chance and things like this. And it muddies the waters. And I think that's part of what he's saying in these comments here. Now, when he says on this, he's complaining about the problem knowing our vitals is our priests of both creeds, and then he says, it's all written down in my big book.
Right.
Yeah, now, what do you think he meant by that statement, Carol?
Well, what I just said, he's keeping track of all this, but he doesn't need to. He knows. And he said eventually he's going to take measures against the churches. He's going to take mm-hmm. measures against it. But
right.
he's not going to do it now because, for one thing, he's embroiled in war and there's all kinds
sure.
of, you know, there's a time for things. But he's telling,
right.
and Himmler's there, and that things may have come up like that. And Speer was sympathetic to those views too, I think. So although he changed after the Nuremberg trial, he changed around totally, but he was, but you know, so he's saying, I want to do something, you know, because I know it's a problem. So he agreed. He agreed with people like Himmler that it was a problem, but maybe he didn't think exactly the way Himmler did. I can't say that. I don't know, but.
Yeah. But you're right that he couldn't take this on at that time because of, my goodness, all the battles he's already fighting, and that would have added to the burden and just been an impossible situation.
Oh, yeah.
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 Okay, we'll move on to the 8th of February, 1942, in the evening, special guest Himmler and Speer on the forms of government in Europe and the United States. The United States of America were born as a republic. That's what distinguishes that country from the European nations. Amongst the latter, the republican form has been a successor to the monarchical form. In Great Britain, the head of state is merely a symbol. In fact, it's the prime minister who governs. In Europe, only Germany has a form of state that approximates to that of the United States. In America, the Chamber of Electors does not play a permanent role. As for the Supreme Court, it cannot reverse the president's decision unless they are unconstitutional or unless they infringe upon the prerogatives of Congress. The president of the United States has a much wider power than the Kaiser had, for he depended on Parliament. In Germany, if things had remained normal, the monarchy would more and more have approximated to the English form. The king in Great Britain is merely the guardian of the Constitution. And it's only by directly influencing people that he can exercise an influence, provided, moreover, that he's clever enough on
now,
the political level.
Now, there's something
level.
In parentheses.
That's right.
That is probably
right.
him.
Mm-hmm.
But the guy writing it thought he should put it in parentheses because the way it was said.
Yeah.
Well, I'll keep that in mind.
The House of Lords, which is practically without influence, is a house of benefice holders. It acts as a means of sidetracking men in politics whose talents are becoming dangerous. With us, a man who controlled a majority in the Reichstag could govern against the president. To avoid the crisis that might arise from this duality, I've united in one and the same function the role of the chancellor, who is responsible to Parliament, and that of the head of state. But I'm not of the opinion that the Führer is appointed for life. At the end of a certain time, the head of the state must give way to a successor. And so,
you know,
anyway,
he was already looking for a successor then. And
yes.
He was already ready to retire. I mean, you know,
mm-hmm.
he wanted to still be around and, of course, important and able to initiate a lot of things. But he didn't want to, he was ready to turn it over to somebody else if somebody else came along. Because he was kind of tired of having to do all that. I think. And he was building his retirement home and everything. And looking forward to that, to life,
mm-hmm.
a different way of life. So these are not just throwaway words here.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, timeline for, now what is this next section? My PDF didn't have the date right. It was garbled. What is the date?
Okay, it says 9th of February, 1942, midday,
okay.
Special guest, Speer.
It is the 9th. All right, so I have the timeline for the 9th here, which is that the British troops are now in full retreat into Singapore,
yes.
a final defense.
Yes.
And also, separately, the top United States military leaders hold their first formal meeting to discuss America's military strategy in the war. You know, first I thought, well, what does that mean? You know, so what? They just stick all this stuff in there that says something about the United States. But I guess the top military leaders are having the first time they're meeting formally. And it's already 9th of February. They declared war on December, whatever it was, previously, and they're going to discuss their American military strategy in the war.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it says, anyway.
Yeah. Okay, the special guest, Speer, the farce of gas masks, the economics of the cults, Obersalzberg. The spectacle of the publicity to which the gas masks have been exposed in England convinces me that this is a piece of commercial exploitation in which the top men are mixed up. To make a few hundred thousand pounds, nobody minds putting on fancy dress airs and going about with a mask slung over one shoulder, the more so as the case might contain a satisfactory supply of cigars. One must clearly see into all that in order to appreciate properly the significance of the exclamation made by the Roosevelt woman, speaking of ourselves, "It's a world in which we could not conceivably live." Just like the throne and the altar in former times, so now the Jews and the political profiteers form a silent association for the common exploitation of the democratic milch cow. Now, we'll stop right there for a second, Carolyn, because what you laughed at there I thought was kind of funny, too, because it's a statement that Eleanor Roosevelt made about Germany, about the country, the form of government it had, when she said, "It's a world when we could not conceivably, in which we could not conceivably live." Well, that's the damn truth.
Right. He said that even in a he gave a speech, and it might have been a speech in the Reichstag even, where he quoted her. And and he said it so funny, like here he calls her the Roosevelt woman, which I think is funny. But in this speech, I think he called her, he was talking about Franklin Roosevelt. And then he said,
yes.
And then the wife says, and then he quotes stuff from Eleanor, but he does never say her name. The
yes.
wife he calls her, and here he's calling her the Roosevelt woman. He detested her. Because there
yes.
was a woman who was, very different from what they allowed in National in Socialist Germany. There was a woman who was mouthing off all she wanted,
yeah.
you know, about
yeah.
About these matters. And he figured she should shut up because she doesn't know. But, you know, everybody honors her here in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Gee, I grew up thinking she was this wonderful woman that everybody said she was. But I finally
mm-hmm.
figured.
Well, but and then that next sentence, golly, you talk about a powerful truth in that, where he says, just like the throne and the altar in former times, So now the Jews and the political profiteers form a silent association for the common exploitation of the democratic milch cow. Boy, does that say this. And when he says the combination of the Jews and the political profiteers, that's Roosevelt and his circle to the nth degree. So he's nailed them for exactly what they were.
And
the exploitation of the democratic milk cow, what he's talking about is the American people being exploited.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And the whole
system
does
that. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And he goes on by saying, if instead of giving $500 million to the church, we made grants to some archbishops, allowing them full freedom to share out as they chose the sums put at their disposal, it's certain that the number of their collaborators would be reduced to the minimum. They'd try to keep the greater part of the money for themselves, and they'd burst themselves in the attempt to be useful to us. With a tenth part of our budget for religion, we would thus have a church devoted to the state and of unshakable loyalty. We must have done with these out-of-date forms, the little sects, S-E-C-T-S, which receive only a few hundred thousand marks, are devoted to us, body and soul. Let's abolish the control on money given to the churches. In accordance with that strictly Christian principle, let not thy left hand know what thy right hand doeth. This mania for control should be regarded as an offense against these just men. Let them fill their own pockets and give us a bit of peace. Those rainy days at Birch's Garden, oh, what a blessing they were. No violent exercise, no excursions, no sunbaths, a little repose. Nothing lovelier in the world than a mountain landscape. There was a time when I could have wept for grief on having to leave Birch's Garden. As far as possible, one must avoid ruining landscapes with networks of high-tension wires, Telfer railways, and machines of that sort. I'm in favor of roads when needs must, but what's uglier than a funicular?
Good, I did too. So you say.
Well, it's of a mountain side railway.
In other words, it goes up and down.
Oh yeah.
The cars
right,
go up and
cables.
The cars come down. Yeah, on
mm-hmm.
cables.
Yeah. And in his opinion, that certainly defaced the beautiful countryside. It would be like putting a bunch of billboards along a scenic highway going through that country, you know, big old billboards, and it would take away from what the natural beauty was. Yeah.
I was going to say that I think it's real funny that, and it's so typical of him. He's kind of tongue in cheek here, but he means it, that he likes the rainy days there because nobody's doing violent exercise, whatever that is, or rushing around like that woman last week to go on long hikes or something, you know. No excursions, no sunbaths, you know, and he likes the quiet repose. I have to agree with him there. And then, his love. And, oh, I was going to say in relation to this ruining the landscapes, how careful he set it up that the Autobahn would be built, always to be as beautiful as possible. And, of course, they didn't have billboards and things there. And they went out of their way to put the Autobahn roads into directions that would take in the exceptional beauty of that area, even when it was cost more money and all of that. So he doesn't get enough credit. They scream and yell in Germany whenever anybody gives Hitler credit for the Autobahn. They just go crazy.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's how that's you know, just another example of how their brains have been fried with poison. So.
Right.
Okay, on New Year's Day, I was obliged to go down to Berchtesgaden to telephone because at Obersalzberg, the telephone wasn't working. The fact was, it was my yearly custom to give sacks of gunpowder to our village shots. They fired them off to their heart's content, playing havoc everywhere with their old rifles and 16th century arquebuses, to the extent of damaging the telephone wires. And I think what he's talking there, shooting clubs, be kind of like the NRA. He said giving sacks of gunpowder to our village shots, and these kind of weapons they were using. That arquebus was a kind of a heavier old flintlock that was or set up on a tripod or a like a Y-shaped frame and to be shot. But it was old kind that used the gunpowder and not bullets.
Yeah, I figured that he was talking about guns that use gunpowder. So it's kind of a hobby thing, and he did it out of it says on New Year's Day. It was just to the I took it that it might be what you say, very very likely. But just these people living there who like to do that, but they probably were in a gun club, so you know, as a gesture, he did a lot of good gestures to the people like that you never hear about. But then they shot down the telephone wires.
Yeah, but you know, hey, New Year's Day celebration.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, the 9th of February, 1942, evening, British fair play, successful air raids, the technological war, revelations on the Narvik landing. The last thing these English know is how to practice fair play. And it says in parentheses here, phrase in English in the original. So they're very bad at accepting their defeats.
I figured the phrase he meant must have just been fair play. They must have thought they should say that. I don't think it'd be any more than just fair play. That fair play is an English expression.
Yeah.
And so that's what was used in the original. And the translators thought they should tell us that.
Yeah, that's right. That's the way it was. And he says, if I had a bomber capable of flying at more than 750 kilometers an hour, I'd have supremacy everywhere. This aircraft would
now here
have
in
to
this case,
armed.
I got to interrupt right here. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You know, here they've got kilometers in parentheses. And I'll bet that he would have been saying 750 an hour. You know, he wouldn't need to say kilometers. And so somebody did stick that in there so that we, the readers, in this case, it might have been the translators, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The readers somehow, you know, would know what he's talking about, not miles or, you know, he's talking about kilometers. It seems to me.
Yeah, well, you know, that if my remembrances are correct, 750 kilometers an hour would translate to 450 miles an hour, which would have been a bodacious speed for an airplane, a bomber.
For a bomber, yeah, right.
Yeah, and he says if he had a bomber that could do that, I would have supremacy everywhere. This aircraft wouldn't have to be armed, for it would be faster than the fastest fighters. In our manufacturing schedules, therefore, we should first attack the problem of bombers instead of giving priority to fighters, where production can catch up quickly. We ought to make such a leap ahead that we could put a great distance between ourselves and our opponents. A bomber flying at a height of 14,000 meters would provide the same safety. But the snag is, it's difficult to aim from so high. 10,000 bombs dropped at random on a city are not as effective as a single bomb aimed with certainty at a powerhouse or a waterworks on which the water supply depends. On the day when the gentry, English word in the original, were deprived of their hydrotherapy, they'd certainly lose some of their conceit. The problem of bombardment should be considered logically. What are the targets to aim for by preference? A bomb of 500 kilograms on a powerhouse undoubtedly produces the required effect. That's what's decisive. With 200 bombers fulfilling these conditions and continuing to fly for 6 months, I'll annihilate the enemy, for it would be impossible for him to catch up with his loss of production during the period. What I've learned from Oshima concerning the Japanese submarine war has filled me both with satisfaction and with anger. The fact is that the pocket submarine, with only two men aboard, has been suggested to us several times. With what an air of superiority our specialists rejected it. In the technological war, it's the side which arrives at a given point with the necessary weapon that wins the battle. If we succeed this year in getting our new tanks into the line of the proportion of 12 per division, we'll crushingly outclass all our opponents' tanks. It's enough to give Rommel 24 of them to guarantee him the advantage. If the Americans arrive with their tanks, he'll bowl them over like rabbits. What's important is to have the technical superiority in every case at a decisive point. I know that. I'm mad on technique. We must meet the enemy with novelties that take him by surprise so as continually to keep the initiative. If the three transports that we wanted to send to Narvik had arrived safely, our warships would not have been sunk, and history would have taken a different course. Supposing I'd known the exact situation, I'd immediately have recalled my men for lack of audacity. Praise and thanks to the Cretan who carried negligence to the point of not informing us that our transports couldn't get through. The fact that our enterprise was nevertheless successful, that was a real defiance of fate, for we had no reasonable chance of succeeding. It's likewise an event unique in history that we charged to attack a port, believing it to be fortified, and therefore hoping that we could use it as a base, and this all the more inasmuch as we had from the former Minister of War of the nation concerned information that later proved to be false. A savory detail is that Churchill at once sent his son to Norway, an urchin like that, to trumpet the arrival of the British liberators. Our good luck was that the English surprised some of our ships, especially the one that was carrying the flak, and that flak is capitalized. Contrary to the orders I'd given, the men of this unit were wearing their uniform. The English returned whence they had come, long enough to ask for instructions, and it's to this chance circumstance we owed our ability to be the first to land. The best proof that these swine wanted to try something that time is that they were in a state of fury. The fact is, we frustrated their intentions by having our information published in the Norwegian and Danish press. What a post-mortem they must have held to find out how we were informed. As for their Sicilian intrigues, they've been nipped in the bud by Kesselring's arrival. So, this battle of Narvik, I think you had something on that.
Well, just to mention here about the Sicilian intrigues and Kesselring, here's another situation where I'm saying to myself, Kesselring arrival might have looked good in the beginning, but the Sicilian campaign didn't go very well at all, and it didn't last very long. So, but anyway, what he's saying here about Narvik is probably totally confusing to most people. Without knowing, he's talking to people who know what's been going on. I don't know why he's talking about it here. Maybe he just learned some things because it was in 1940. But
yes.
I'm just to give some background on that I was looking to even help myself. I have something here. I'll read this first from Wikipedia, which is kind of going back, and one of the heroes of this Narvik victory was this Edward Dietl, who has been a guest at the dinners before, and he was then, by then, a general, I think, but he wasn't a general at this time, and he was a commander of one of the battle groups, the one that succeeded in gaining the victory there in Norway, in Narvik, which was totally necessary there to get the victory in Norway, but anyway, about these ships, German ships were sunk, two of them, and some other things. But that somehow turned into something that helped Germany in the end. So it says here from Wiki, the next day, 15th February, we're talking about 1940, Altmark, one of the ships, was spotted by three British aircraft. The discovery of the ship's location led the Royal Navy to send six destroyers to the area. In order to escape the approaching warships, the Altmark fled into the Jøsingfjord. At the time, Altmark was escorted by three Norwegian warships, the torpedo boat Kjell and Skarv and the patrol boat of Fyren. As Cossack, another ship, entered the fjord at 22:20 local time, the Norwegian vessels did not intervene when the British boarded Altmark. So the British came and boarded the Altmark, the German ship. It says the boarding action led to the freeing of 299 Allied prisoners of war that were held on the German ship. That was talked about earlier. And then the boarding party killed seven Germans in the process. Following the incident, the Germans sent strong protests to the Norwegian government. And I think this was part of what woke the Germans up to the need to get really to take control of Norway. I think that's what it's getting at here. But the Norwegians, on their hand, sent protests to the British government. While Norwegian, Swedish, and American experts in international law described the British action as a violation of Norwegian neutrality, the United Kingdom declared the incident was at most a technical violation that had been morally justified. Probably maybe because they had those prisoners on board, I don't know. But this is, you know, and this is from Wikipedia, so it's not taking German side necessarily. And then the Altmark incident led to the Germans speeding up their planning for an invasion of Norway. On 21st February, General Nicholas von Falkenhorst was placed in charge of planning the invasion and in command of the land-based forces. The official approval for the invasion and occupation of Denmark and Norway was signed by Hitler on March 1st. Now I'm going to go to something from Hermann Giesler, that's from my website under the Ayn Andrew Hitler articles. This one's under war campaigns, and in the particular the one, the West Offensive, or the offensive in the West. And one of the side stories that we wrote was ahead of the Allies at Narvik. That is Narvik. The Germans got ahead of the Allies in Narvik. So I'm going to. I think it's not too much time. It doesn't take too long to read this because I think it's interesting. So this sheds more light on it. During the preparations for the West Offensive, by Hitler, alarming reports of naval and troop concentrations in East Anglia, which I guess is East England, arrived at Hitler's headquarters from Admiral Canaris Abwehr, Chief of Operations Jodl, that is the staff, Alfred Jodl, the operations chief at headquarters, and Colonel General Nikolaus von Falkenhorst, which we already mentioned, were certain that this meant the British were preparing to invade Norway and realized the great danger of being cut off from the vital supply of Swedish iron ore and the encirclement from the north. Hitler reacted swiftly, ordering the invasion of Denmark and Norway under the code name Vaserubung on April 9th, 1940. Hermann Giesler reports in Ayn Andrew Hitler about the tremendous tension and pressure being felt at headquarters in Berlin. And here is Giesler's recollections from his book. And he says, during the decisive battle in Norway, especially around Narvik, I was Adolf Hitler's guest for lunch and dinner at the Reich's Chancellery. After the evening military meeting, Hitler returned to the Bismarck living quarters, that is probably the living room of the Reich's Chancellery, and he wanted to talk until the reports arrived. He was restless, under tension, and had been worried for hours. His greatest worry is the battle for Narvik. That's why he is restless. The battle group Dietl is too weak, it was named after the commander, of the battle group. Is too weak to resist the massive enemy forces still being strengthened by the English fleet and their ample supply. By his order, that is, by Hitler's order, our soldiers are involved in a desperate fight against that superior power, and we cannot help them. There is no way to get any help to them. Any supply possibilities by sea are prevented by the English. A land bridge is impossible. How long will they be able to hold on? To stay in Narvik is of utmost importance. Then a quote from Hitler. He says to Giesler, "Do you understand how I feel? I question myself. Is it time for the battle group to move into Swedish territory and surrender? General Jodl pleads for continued fighting. I now recognize, remembering my own time as a soldier, it is easier to fight than to be responsible for the battle." Well, Giesler, let's walk up and down until new reports arrive. He was very upset about this and concerned, and he was actually thinking about telling that group to go into Sweden and give up what they had gained because they were in such a serious bad situation there. But Jodl, in this case, said, no, let them continue. So Hitler's waiting for new reports to come in. So Giesler writes, "Messages arrived continuously, very hard fights around Narvik, fights against English and Norwegian forces in the valleys north and south of Trondheim. One question was in Hitler's mind, where is the Norwegian king? Did they succeed in capturing him?" Then the decisive message came in. "The keep on fighting, hang on tough, paid off. We succeeded. The king, who was with his troops in the north, offered to surrender. He may have recognized that further resistance of his troops was senseless. The German forces pushed forward. The fighting against the English-French Expeditionary Corps continued, but the success of that bold Norway operation was assured. Now Hitler had to face a new burdensome responsibility, the battle against the West. He said, Giesler, we beat the English by only a few hours. A dangerous threat for Germany from the north could have occurred." Well, it was kind of a lucky thing, you know, the way things worked out. And some other places in what we're going to be reading here, Hitler mentions that here. That things didn't seem to be going well, but then it turned out that what was a mistake helped them in the end in some strange way, you know. He sees that a lot of times. I think he thinks about it in terms of providence. But anyway, well, that's all I had to contribute on that.
Well, it was a very interesting situation, and the British, of course, were trying to beat Germany to Norway.
Right.
And there they were at the same time with their war propaganda, you know, saying the Nazi invaders, they're invading the Norway, Sweden, Denmark, all this stuff, and yet the British were trying to do the same thing. They wanted to take over Norway, as you read there, so that these iron ore shipments from Sweden, very valuable to the Germans, could be cut off.
To control Germany from the north. Yeah, I mean, they were not innocent in the least little bit.
That's exactly right.
Just in this case, Germany won, and it was a wonderful, very, very important victory. Very important.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, we'll move on to the 10th of February, 1942, evening, special guest Himmler, Motor Cars and Their Drivers.
I have an interesting timeline for the 10th,
okay.
I'm sorry. It says the cruise ship, which was American, no, was it? Anyway, the cruise liner SS Normandy catches fire and capsizes in New York Harbor. Maybe that's a British ship, cruise liner, but whatever it is. It says that although the cause is probably a welder's torch, various conspiracies are imagined in the media. Ha!
Mm-hmm.
See, they use it to further the war hysteria by saying, what kind of German people got in there and set that ship on fire, but they never found any evidence of anything like that.
Right.
Yeah. But anyway, they lost one of their cruisers.
Yeah. All right. Adolf Müller's, the man to whom I owe the fact that I can understand the art of driving a car. Müller had very much vexed me by saying that my car was not a car but a saucepan, that my drivers drove like dummies, and that if I went on as I was doing, I wouldn't last long.
It wouldn't last long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. When a car loses one of its wheels, he said, this is what had just happened to mine, it's ready for the scrap heap, and so is its driver. Thus, Müller. Since he was going to Wurzburg to buy a rotary press, Mueller suggested I should come with him. He arrived at our rendezvous very oddly attired, and his knickerbockers were only a detail in this rig-out. When he told me he would himself drive his car, my first reaction was to inform him that I wouldn't come with him. "Get in," he told me, "and you'll learn what it is to drive a car." I must honestly confess that the journey was a revelation to me. Unlike most people, I'm always ready to learn. The car itself, first of all, was a 16-horse Benz, and it was in absolutely impeccable condition. By comparison, I saw at once all the faults of my own car. And I must add that Mueller drove wonderfully well. Secondly, Mueller opened my eyes to an infinite number of small details that escape most drivers. Every pedestrian who is installed behind a wheel at once loses his sense of the consideration to which he is convinced he's entitled while he's a pedestrian.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Mueller never stopped thinking of the people on the road. He drove very carefully through built-up areas. He believed that anyone who runs over a child should be put in prison at once. He didn't skirt the edge of the road, as many people do, but instead he stuck rather to the top of the camber, always mindful of the child who might unexpectedly emerge. When he wanted to pass a car, he first of all made sure that the driver of the car in front of him had taken cognizance of his intention. He took his curves cleverly without making his rear wheel skid and without sudden spurts of acceleration, all gently and flexibly. I realized that driving was something quite different from what I'd hitherto supposed, and I was a little ashamed at the comparisons that forced themselves into my mind. During that journey, I took two decisions. I'd buy a Benz, and I'd teach my drivers to drive. I went to the Benz Works and thus made Werlin's acquaintance. I told him I wanted to buy a 16 horsepower. "You'll decide for yourself in the end," he said. "I'd advise you to try a 10 horsepower to begin with to get your hand in. It does only 80 kilometers an hour, but it's better to arrive at your destination at 80 than to smash yourself up at 110. These were so many dagger thrusts at my pride. Theoretical and practical knowledge are one thing, and presence of mind at the moment of danger is something else. Shrek had them both to the same degree. He was as strong as a buffalo and cold-bloodedly fearless. He used his car as a weapon for charging at communists. Now, he's talking about his drivers here. You know, Shrek is one of them. And then he says, "Kempka has been my driver for nearly 10 years, and I have nothing but praise for him. Moreover, he impeccably manages the collection of cars for which he's responsible. When I ask him in September if he has his stock of oil for the winter and his snow chains, I know he's ready equipped. If I need to know the time, I can rely on the clock on the instrument panel. All the instruments are in perfect working order. I've never had a more conscientious driver. In utterly critical situations, he wouldn't have the same calmness as Shrek. He's entirely wrapped up in his driving. When I had Shrek beside me, it was the old wartime comrade who sat at the wheel. One day I had to be in Hanover with all speed in order to catch the night train for Munich. I'd been lent a car with a Saxon driver. Since we could see nothing, I suggested that he should switch on his headlights. They're switched on, he said, but the battery's flat. A moment later, it was a tire that gave up the ghost. I saw my Saxon becoming very busy with his car, and I asked him whether he hadn't a spare wheel. "I have one, all right," he said, "but it's been flat for some days." It suddenly occurred to me that Lutz must be behind us. Sure enough, he arrived at the wheel of an Opel, the first of the 18-horsepower four-cylinder models, the most wretched car that ever came out of the Opel Works. So I continued my journey with Lutz, and I asked him whether there was any chance of arriving in time for my train. He's an optimist, like all drivers. The unlucky thing for Lutz is that he has only one eye and is a poor judge of distances. He lost no time in going astray at a fork, and suddenly we found ourselves confronted by a ditch. We finally got out of it by using the reverse gear. I didn't worry. I was already resigned to missing that train. Lutz drove through Hanover at a crazy speed. Another 5 minutes, another 2 minutes to go. We arrived in the station. I had just time to leap into the train. I've had some queer drivers in my time. Goring made a point of always driving on the left-hand side of the road. In moments of danger, he used to blow his horn. His confidence was unfailing, but it was of a somewhat mystic nature. Killinger was also an ace at the wheel. Once I saw Bastion get down peacefully from his car, knock out some fools who had jeered at him, take the wheel again, and move off in complete calm. One day I was a passenger in a car that was taking me back from Mainz. Shrek was driving behind us in a car equipped with a siren. We arrived in the middle of a bunch of cyclists. They were Reds and began to hurl insults at us. But when they heard Shrek's siren, they left their bicycles on the road and scattered into the fields. Shrek went by quite calmly, crushing all the bicycles. The Reds were taken aback, wondering how a police car could behave like that. When they realized their mistake, they began to abuse us again in their choicest terms. Murderers, bandits, Hitlerites. They recognize me, and I take that fact as my badge of rank. We often had very painful incidents of this kind. It was no joke at that time to find oneself at grips with a mob of opponents. When one has been driven for years by the same men, one no longer sees them as drivers, but as party comrades. And that's a nice little bit of escapism there from the heavier things that he's been talking about.
That's great. I like his writing about driving and cars and his drivers and so on, better than anything else. I love the one before, and I love this one, too. He's a very good storyteller, isn't he?
He doesn't
waste a lot of words like I would. I mean, he comes right to the point, but he tells it in such a way that you get the humor of it. It's very funny. Of course, the funniest part is Shrek just driving, continuing on, driving over those bicycles.
Yes, and then earlier he had said Shrek was as strong as a buffalo, cold-bloodedly fearless. He used his car as a weapon for charging at communists.
Right. Anyway. So he was used to doing that. He didn't have to think twice about it. And then it was funny when he says that the Reds were taken aback, wondering how a police car could behave like that.
Yeah, because they heard that siren and they thought it was.
Thought they were the police. And they thought, wow, how are these police driving over our bicycles? And then they realized their mistake. And then they really got mad. But must have been something, huh? Some of those experiences.
That was a nice little bit of humor during that. So.
I've got a timeline for the 11th. What month are we in? February 11th, 1942, was the famous Channel Dash. The battleships Scharnhorst and Gneisenau, with the cruiser Prince Eugen, moved out of Brest under cover of darkness in clouds through the English Channel, and the English tried to bomb them and from the shore and from ships and from planes, but didn't succeed in stopping them and injuring them, and they got to where they were going and Wilhelmshaven and north of there. And it was a big victory for the Germans at that time because those ships were endangered, stuck down further down, I forget now, in Brest Harbor. That happened then. And then on the 15th, Singapore surrenders to Japanese forces, as you already told us. And according to Wikipedia, this is arguably the most devastating loss in British military history.
That's right.
On the 16th, American government circles are discussing plans for the internment of Japanese Americans who live generally in the Western United States. And on the 17th, orders are given for Rangoon to be evacuated as Japanese forces approach. So this is what's happening here. by the 17th of February.
Right.
Okay.
17th of February, 1942, midday, special guest is Himmler. Fascists and aristocrats. Roata the rat. The Duce should sacrifice the monarchy. The Jews and the natural order. The unhealthy intellectuals of Europe. If the German professor ruled the world. The genuine fascists are friendly to Germany, but the court circles, the clique of aristocrats, detest everything German. At Florence, the Duce said to me, "My soldiers are brave fellows, but I can't have any confidence in my officers." The last time I met Mussolini, his accents were still more tragic. I learned, with Pfeffer, that when men acquire the habit of a certain type of behavior and make the gestures corresponding to it, it ends by becoming second nature to them. Words lose their meaning. The best established notions create new events. With them, pride becomes transformed into vanity. Egotism becomes confused with idealism. It's difficult to conceive that a genuine officer can be a sneaking spy. Now, that was just what Roata was. He sabotaged the plan of attack by Italian troops along the valley of the Rhine in June of 1940. Until the Duce succeeds in getting rid of this aristocratic mafia, he won't be able to appoint a genuine elite to the highest posts. This mafia is every bit as base as the German underworld. It's composed of cretins, who, however, are not so cretinous as to not have a sense of what gives other people their superiority. Their activities, although purely negative, are nonetheless effective, for these are the people who prevent the best men from gaining access to the highest posts. And this conspiracy is what paralyzes the Duce's efforts. Things won't improve in Italy until the Duce has sacrificed the monarchy and taken effective control of an authoritarian state. This form of government can last for centuries. The Republic of Venice lasted for 960 years. It ruled the Eastern Mediterranean throughout that period, and that thanks to the authority conferred upon the Doge. Under the monarchic form, that would not have been possible. Venice couldn't have claimed more, but whatever she coveted and whatever lay within the scope of her ambition, she got. The example of the Hanseatic cities likewise proves the quality of the system. All that they lacked was the imperial power. It's not possible that 6,000 families can have, on the one hand, maintained perpetual dominion over 340,000 helots, and on the other hand, reigned over Asia Minor and Sicily. The fact that they succeeded in doing so for several centuries is a proof of the greatness of this race. The sensational event of the ancient world was the mobilization of the underworld against the established order. This enterprise of Christianity had no more to do with religion than Marxist socialism has to do with the solution of the social problem. The notions represented by Jewish Christianity were strictly unthinkable to Roman brains. The ancient world had a liking for clarity. Scientific research was encouraged there. The gods, for the Romans, were familiar images. It is somewhat difficult to know whether they had any exact idea of the beyond. For them, eternal life was personified in living beings, and it consisted in a perpetual renewal. Those were conceptions fairly close to those which were current among the Japanese and Chinese at the time when the swastika made its appearance amongst them. It was necessary for the Jew to appear on the scene and introduce that mad conception of a life that continues into an alleged beyond. It enables one to regard life as a thing that is negligible here below, since it will flourish later when it no longer exists. Under cover of religion, the Jew has introduced intolerance in a sphere in which tolerance formerly prevailed. Amongst the Romans, the cult of the sovereign intelligence was associated with the modesty of a humanity that knew its limits, to the point of consecrating altars to the unknown God. The Jew who fraudulently introduced Christianity into the ancient world, in order to ruin it, reopened the same breach in modern times, this time taking as his pretext the social question. It's the same sleight of hand as before. Just as Saul was changed into St. Paul, Mordecai became Karl Marx. Peace can result only from a natural order. The condition of this order is that there is a hierarchy among nations. The most capable nations must necessarily take the lead. In this order, the subordinate nations get the greater profit, being protected by the more capable nations. It is Jewry that always destroys this order. It constantly provokes the revolt of the weak against the strong, of bestiality against intelligence, of quantity against quality. It took 14 centuries for Christianity to reach the peak of savagery and stupidity. We would therefore be wrong to sin by excess of confidence and proclaim our definite victory over Bolshevism. The more we render the Jew incapable of harming us, the more we shall protect ourselves from this danger. The Jew plays in nature the role of a catalyzing element. A people that is rid of its Jews returns spontaneously to the natural order. In 1925, I wrote in Mein Kampf, and also in an unpublished work, that world Jewry saw in Japan an opponent beyond its reach. The racial instinct is so developed amongst the Japanese that the Jew realizes he cannot attack Japan from within. He is therefore compelled to act from outside. It would be to the considered interest of England and the United States to come to an understanding with Japan, but the Jew will strive to prevent such an understanding. I gave this warning in vain. A question arises, does the Jew act consciously and by calculation, or is he driven on by his instinct? I cannot answer that question. The intellectual elite of Europe, whether professors, of faculties, high officials, or whatever else, never understood anything of this problem. The elite has been stuffed with false ideas, and on these it lives. It propagates a science that causes the greatest possible damage. Stunted men have the philosophy of stunted men. They love neither strength nor health, and they regard weakness and sickness as supreme values. Since it's the function that creates the organ, entrust the world for a few centuries to a German professor, and you'll soon have a mankind of cretins made up of men with big heads set upon meager bodies.
Yeah. All right. He doesn't believe in too much education for most people. When he says, I like when he says here in this very last paragraph here, over-educating people. He thinks that, you know, this idea that that everybody has to be in school for so long is wrong. You know, the party thought that. Some of them, yes, went on to further education, but everybody needed to get plenty of outdoor activity and they needed to be involved in sports and things that built up their bodies rather than have weak bodies with big smart heads on them. And, you know, it didn't take me too long to come to agree with that because most people
yes.
don't need to be so overly educated. And what they need is to have a good education in how to be good citizens of their country. And then mm-hmm. if they're treated with respect, that you don't have to go around getting degrees in order to get respect.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has respect for what they do. So it was a very healthy society, I think, the German National Socialist Society.
Certainly, I agree there.
And so what else do you want to comment on this section?
Well, when he says here in 1925, I wrote in Mein Kampf, such, and then he says, the racial instinct is so developed amongst the Japanese that the Jew realizes he cannot attack Japan from within. He's got to organize a bunch of bandits to crush the Japanese from the outside. Well, what I thought of when I saw that about him saying the Japanese racial instinct is so developed that the Jew can't do anything with them, years and years ago, I read a lot of Henry Ford's writings, and one of the quotes that I read, he was writing about the Red Scare of the 1920s, when communist activity was flaring up among the working, the unions, and all this, and the country was pretty, you know, it was indeed a Red Scare, and Henry Ford wrote, "Don't worry about communism," he says, "we have no need to fear communism All we need to do is to call our sons home to a pride of race, because Ford recognized at that time, too, that communism was Jewish. The last thing Jews want is any other race that is proud of itself and well-organized and can't be penetrated. And that's exactly what I thought of, about that racial situation with Japan, that the Jews couldn't do anything with them and manipulate them because they were too racially united.
Yeah, and, very good.
And thank you. And there's one other thing here. When he says, a question arises, does the Jew act consciously and by calculation, or is he driven on by his instinct? I can't answer that question. Well, I wrote in big letters right behind that sentence, both. But I'm sure he was trying to select one or the other, but I personally think it's both.
You think it's both?
At any rate.
Well, that's interesting, Ray, because that struck me too, because, this debate is going on currently. There's a big debate. Some people say it's the biological Jew, and
yes.
The Jew has to act the way he does. He can't help himself, and he's never going to change. And then others say, well, the Jew is doing it for reasons of getting ahead and gaining power, and so it's all a calculation. Yeah, I would agree that it's both. I don't know if I could go along with the idea that every Jew is biologically somehow determined to act in a parasitic way, but they all seem to do. They all seem to do that, but I can't bring myself to think that it's that, absolutely biological. But I would say, yeah, there's some of both of that. Now, one thing I didn't want to miss commenting on is this paragraph ahead, before that, that you already talked about. In 1925, I wrote in Mein Kampf and also in an unpublished work. Now, that also in an unpublished work is in parentheses. And that's why,
yes,
I got so worked up over this what this parentheses means. Because first,
yes,
I thought, well, he's saying that he wrote this not only in Mein Kampf, but in this book that is called Hitler's Second Book. Sometimes it's called Hitler's Secret Book, but that so many people say is it was not written by Hitler. But this time it's clear that he's saying an unpublished work, not in,
yes,
Mein Kampf. But I don't know if this is him or saying this or somebody else put that in there. But I have noticed quite a few parentheses in what we're reading tonight. And one of them I noticed above was clearly Hitler. Hitler said it, but it was in parentheses still. So, and here's the thing. A translator puts something into the text, that it's usually in brackets. Translators
That's
put
right.
it in brackets. Yeah, this is all in parentheses. I have a couple more little comments I can say real quick here. Oh, yeah, this is important to me. He says, peace can result only from a natural order. The condition of this order is that there is a hierarchy amongst nations. The most capable nations must necessarily take the lead. And then he says, in this order, the subordinate nations get the greater profit, being protected by the more capable nations. And that, to me, is an important statement, and he said it very well. And
very much so.
And most capable nations also means those who will stand up against the Jew, because he's put it in here in this part. He's talking
sure.
about Jews. Because weak nations won't do it. They can't do it. I'm coming to that conclusion more and more very clearly that for anything to happen, it has to be led. And it has to be led by those most capable of leading it. And he's talking about the most capable nations. I don't think you can disagree with that. And that
No.
has to be understood by everybody. And we need to get away from falling into the trap of the political correctness of saying that all whites or all Europeans are equal. They should all have an equal voice and things and so on. Because that's not going to take us where we need to go.
No.
I mean, they have to be, like he says, they have to be a part of the whole thing, but they can't have an equal voice.
That's right. And that very philosophy that you just expounded on there about the best of the nations that should lead, hey, switch that to individuals. I mean, that's the same thing. That's just meritocracy, and things go out of kilter and cannot work if the natural order of things is not followed.
That's right. So. That's right. It's so simple, isn't it? It's so clear, mm-hmm. and it was all very, very clear to Adolf Hitler.
Right.
I know that. I can tell that. Everybody can tell.
Sure.
That's why he was such a good spokesman for it all. And he never got thrown off base by anything.
Right. Right.
Because it was all very clear to him. Well, Ray, it's been a great show tonight, I think. Do you have any last comment you want to make?
I've really enjoyed it. I thought this was another very nice section. And a lot of things, like I said during the show, hit home with me that he said. And I enjoyed it. And I'm looking forward to next week. We'll be back on our regular Thursday schedule, September 11th, if my thinking is correct.
And thanks for mentioning that and reminding the listeners of that. This mm-hmm. Wednesday show has been just a one-time deal. So have a good time tomorrow and Friday with your football announcing.
Well, thank you.
Ray, you got two nights in a row to do that.
That's correct. I'm just going to say good night, folks, and I've enjoyed it, and I hope you join us again next week.
Very good. And so I say good night, too.